From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Trump and Clinton talked about race last night. We'll hear from two politically involved black women about what they heard and what they liked.
I believe African-American voters or individuals, particularly here in Michigan, are looking for law and order in their neighborhoods.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement is a no-go for both presidential candidates, but groups representing Michigan farmers say we need TPP.
If we don't step up and embrace trade, we're going to be the losers.
The price you paid for your electronic device and its components might be funding conflict in an African country.
Those resources are worth a lot of money. And so if you have the weapons, if you have the armed group that controls the area, you control those minerals.
And why your local government just might be going broke. Those stories and a defense of fracking. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Later in the program, a Michigan filmmaker focuses on civil strife in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Plus, a look at what's happened to the Michigan oil and gas industry. But first, the first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton was held last night. A large segment was about racial healing in the U.S. Both candidates have been pursuing African-American and Latino votes. Joining us to talk about that are Linda Lee Tarver. She's co-chair of the Trump-Pence Michigan African American Advisory Committee, and a member of Congress, Brenda Lawrence, a Democrat who supports Clinton. First, let's hear some of what Mr. Trump said about his concerns.
Law and order. And we need law and order. If we don't have it, we're not going to have a country. And when I look at what's going on in Charlotte, a city I love, a city where I have investments, when I look at what's going on throughout various parts of our country, whether it's, I can just keep naming them all day long. We need law and order in our country. And I just got today the endorsement of the Fraternal Order of Police. We just came in. We have endorsements from, I think, almost every police group, a large percentage of them in the United States. We have a situation where we have our inner cities, African-Americans, Hispanics, are living in hell because it's so dangerous.
Ms. Tarver, are African-American voters asking for a law and order president?
I believe African-American voters or individuals or citizens of this country, and particularly here in Michigan, are looking for law and order in their neighborhoods. That is what is necessary here. I've shared several times before that I've had three family members murdered, one in Lansing, Michigan, one in Chicago, and one in Atlanta. And their lives matter. And we do need law and order. We do. I think the political approach is one thing, but I think the common sense approach that Mr. Trump is putting forth is law and order. And that is what is needed. We need rule of law. We need to make sure that we are able to report things that are occurring and being able to keep our neighborhood safe. So I think that's what he was addressing. And I'm quite proud of the approach that he's taken and quite proud that the FOP decided to endorse him.
Congresswoman Lawrence, are your constituents and people of color are living in Michigan's urban areas living in hell because it's so dangerous, as Mr. Trump said?
I would not use the word living in hell. I will say clearly, with gun violence and the number of deaths as a result of gun violence, we clearly have concerns about communities throughout Michigan. However, I will tell you that the contrast between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump last night was so clear. Hillary Clinton understands systemic racism has played a major part and race issues in America. If you educate a child, putting resources into education is extremely important. To take away that profit of imprisoning someone and to make sure that we are doing more than just locking people up, law and order, as I heard it from Donald Trump, is we need more police. Well, you know, when you have police in a community, are they trained? Are these police fulfilling a pattern of systemic racism that says that if an African American is stopped, and we've seen this on those videos all over the country, they are immediately shot? Where if you have someone who's not an African American or not Latino or a minority, then there is this step-by-step de-escalation of the situation. There's a lot that's on the table here. You can't go in and say that because I'm African American, I'm living in hell. So I want a president, and I can tell you the African American wants a president that understands I need jobs. I need education. And if I have a job and I have education, then I have the ability to have a quality of life that reduces the amount of criminal activity.
Let's hear some of what Secretary Clinton said last night. She criticized Mr. Trump for being too harsh in describing the lives of African Americans and not recognizing the good things in the black community, the black church. Then she went on to describe the systemic racism in the justice system that you mentioned just a second ago.
Too many young African American and Latino men ended up in jail for nonviolent offenses. And it's just a fact that if you're a young African American man and you do the same thing as a young white man, you are more likely to be arrested, charged, convicted, and incarcerated. So we've got to address the systemic racism in our criminal justice system. We cannot just say law and order. We have to say we have to come forward with a plan that is going to divert people from the criminal justice system, deal with mandatory minimum sentences, which have put too many people away for too long for doing too little.
Congresswoman Lawrence, how do you think that statement was received by black voters in Michigan?
The African-American community, we are American citizens just like everyone else here. If we get an education, if we get the opportunity to have a job, we will clearly be able to have a quality of life, get the opportunities that this United States of America promised. But when you have for-profit prisons taking the testing scores of third graders to predict how many prisons they need to build to house them, because if a child is not performing in the third grade, the likelihood of them continuing on, graduating from high school, becoming an employed American is reduced. We've got to stop that in America. George Bush said that a country who does not accept their history and understand and embrace it so that you can get better is a country that is not going to be strong and not going to be a leader. And we have to accept the reality here. Don't walk around with blindfolds on and labeling me because I'm African American. Understand that systemic racism in America is real, and let's get about the business of removing those barriers so that all of us in America can achieve. And for the record, every African-American in the inner city is not living in hell.
Ms. Tarver, Mr. Trump says he has a very good relationship with the African-American community, but recent polls show only about 3% of black voters intend to vote for him. How do you account for that contradiction?
Well, there's a poll that shows in California that it's 20% in double digits in Michigan. But I wanted to address, since this is supposed to be a balanced interview, I want to address some of the issues that were brought up, particularly for the candidate that I plan on supporting. The issue that we definitely agree on is there was a stark contrast with Mr. Trump and Mrs. Clinton. And the contrast is that in terms of the third grade reading level, yes, the third grade reading level is a challenge. But in Michigan, here in Michigan, the Democrats on the State Board of Education would not require that children read by third grade. The third grade reading level and education is important in the inner cities, but in communities where I live, in the African American communities, our schools are substandard and subpar. We do need quality education. When it comes to the streets, my husband's three nephews were murdered in Detroit. There is a hell going on in Detroit. People should not live in those conditions. People should be able to freely go and walk and be able to have buses run on time and street lights on in the city of Detroit. So, yes, I lived in Detroit, too. I had to live a certain way that I can't live anywhere else. There were certain protections that I had to take, certain roads I didn't go down, certain times of night, certain places that I couldn't frequent. But that's not the freedom that we enjoy under our Constitution. So Mr. Trump was talking about the freedoms and liberty. He talks about school choice for parents to be able to go and send your child out of a failing school district into a school district that provides, or a school that provides the quality of education so you can get up out of the situations that you live in. Quality of education, Condoleezza Rice said that the education is a new civil rights of our day. That is what is required here for us. In respect to law enforcement, rule of law, and accountability and criminal justice system. President Clinton didn't do anything for that matter for 30 years. Hillary Clinton didn't do anything about the inequities in the criminal justice system. We have inequities when it comes to abortion here in Michigan. We're not talking about the lives of the 12% of the population making up 51% of the abortions here. Those lives matter too. Black babies' lives matter. We're going to be under the endangered species list if we do not stop the trend for black babies being aborted here in Michigan.
We're running out of time here, and I want to give each of you just about 30 seconds to tell me your lasting impressions of last night's debate, particularly on this racial healing section of the debate. And so we'll start with you, Congressman Lawrence. Tell us what your lasting impressions were.
First of all, someone can't count. Hillary Clinton has not been in office for 30 years. The other thing is that we must understand that in America, if we do not understand the systemic racism that exists in our community, and when you try to label and say it's the Democrats that's responsible, clearly in Detroit public schools where the Republican State House and the Republican governor has been directly responsible for the outcomes of education in the city of Detroit, it is not a Democratic issue. This is about leadership. It's not Democrat or Republican. It's about a leader that understands that we in America, whether we black, white, Hispanic, immigrant, or white America, we all deserve the same rights and same consideration to climb the American ladder. And Hillary Clinton understands that.
Ms. Tarver, last thoughts on lasting impressions of the debate last night. 30 seconds, please.
I think there's a stark contrast between a person of change, Mr. Trump, who is a change agent for us, black folks, white folks, every folks in the country is looking at it as a change. They're crying for a change. They need something more than the status quo and a traditional politician who is scripted. We need a better change, and black folks in my community understand that. They clearly heard the difference yesterday, and I believe that they will clearly show you the difference on November 8th when Donald Trump wins Michigan.
Linda Lee Tarver is co-chair of the Trump-Pence Michigan African American Advisory Committee, and Brenda Lawrence is a Democratic member of Congress serving Michigan's 14th District. Thank you both for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Trade agreements have been a big topic of discussion this election year. President Obama has been pushing for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The major party presidential candidates are both opposed to it. The North America Free Trade Agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico has also been criticized this election year. Last week, the agriculture leaders of Michigan released a letter in support of those trade agreements and others. Joining me now is Jim Byram. He's the president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. He was one of those who signed the letter. Could you briefly outline what you're calling for?
Well, I think the most important issue in the letter is very comprehensive, but the message we want to convey is that trade is absolutely critical to agriculture, and it's critical to many industries, but we speak specifically to agriculture. And our concern is that attacking things like NAFTA, agreements like NAFTA, suggesting that TPP be renegotiated or that it be thrown out, or generally vilifying trade as an activity really doesn't recognize what we do and doesn't show any appreciation for what we do in agriculture or a variety of industries in this country. We produce more than we could possibly consume here. We have to have trade. Trade is critical to what we do. And suggesting that we want to scrap NAFTA would actually be scrapping something like $3 billion worth of product that we sell to Mexico and Canada every year, agricultural products, and that would further devastate this industry. We're going through a time when commodity prices are low.
Let me stop you because I want to make clear, that's $3 billion for Michigan alone.
Absolutely, just Michigan. We ship everything from black beans to Mexico to apples to Canada and all sorts of other commodities in between.
The criticisms of the trade agreements are based on the belief that overall the U.S. has not benefited, that it's lost a lot of manufacturing jobs because of NAFTA, would lose more with the TPP. I'm sure you've heard those criticisms. How do you respond to people who don't think they're benefiting from trade agreements like these?
Well, and there is that criticism, no question about it, Lester, but quite frankly, it's important to ask the question, would those jobs have moved anyway, A, and B, in some of those cases, those manufactured products are being manufactured in Mexico, for example, where some of those products are consumed. They previously may have been manufactured here. With TPP, that's been a long negotiated agreement. Goes back several years, work has been underway on that agreement. And it is where it is at this point. It's not as simple as just saying, let's start over from scratch and renegotiate it. I'll give you a classic example. It was announced that the Chinese Prime Minister was in Cuba over the weekend and signed 30 agreements on economic cooperation and trade with Cuba, while we continue to negotiate what we would accept in our trade relationships with Cuba. It's happening all around us. Our competition is taking advantage of those situations. And if we don't step up and embrace trade, we're going to be the losers.
I want to talk about TPP. The letter indicates Michigan dairy and pork could be sold in greater amounts to Asian countries because of the TPP. Are there any hard numbers, or is this just all speculation at this point?
There clearly are opportunities around for markets in those in Southeast Asia and other countries that are, would be a party to TPP, but currently there's trade barriers or there's tariffs that economically prohibit us from being active. With TPP, it would reduce or eliminate those tariffs, which obviously would make us in a, put us in a more economic advantageous situation.
So, again, any hard numbers or any jobs created in Michigan, anything you can point to, even back-of-the-napkin type stuff?
Well, you know, we are looking, we believe that with TPP, we could see untapped opportunity of something like $4.4 billion on an annual basis, and that's out of the box, and that would include dairy, corn, and soybeans. We sell lots of specialty soybeans to Southeast Asian countries already. This would do nothing but enhance those market opportunities. So that's roughly the number. That's the back of the napkin number, if you will, but really, trade opportunities create additional trade opportunities. You know, for example, we have seen commodities work with each other to enhance trade in many countries around the world. Once one gets a foothold, others can take advantage of some of those same opportunities. So we think this is just the beginning of what could be a real great opportunity for agriculture and other industries as well.
When groups gather like this to publish an open letter, they usually have a particular audience in mind. Who do you want to read this, and what do you want them to do?
We are pretty frustrated that if you hear the general conversation, Lester, around trade, there's an awful lot of folks that just want to go back to the way things were however many years ago when we didn't have some trade agreements in place. We want to make sure that people understand that trade does provide opportunity, it does create markets, and it does provide a sound economic footing in Michigan for agriculture and other industries that would be lost if we step back in time. So it really is intended for Congress, it's intended for state legislators, and it's intended for other policy leaders.
Jim Byram is president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. He, along with leaders in dairy, pork, corn, soybeans, and potato growers, issued a letter in support of NAFTA and the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreements. Thanks for explaining this to us.
Lester, appreciate the opportunity, and we just need to recognize that there is more to trade than just downside. There's upside for many, many industries as well.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A country that is one of the most mineral-rich in the world is also one of the poorest nations in the world. The Democratic Republic of Congo has been rocked by war in recent years, and although the war is over, the conflict and suffering are not over. A Michigan filmmaker is out with a new exploration of how the minerals in our electronic devices are funding the turmoil in that African country. Let's take a listen to this clip from the film's trailer.
Congo is strategically important to the United States.
Cobalt is used in manufacturing weapon systems that are important to the U.S. Department of Defense.
In particular, incredibly rich in coltan, which is really important in electronic equipment.
Yeah, well, these minerals. Congo has been a tempting place to foreigners for a long, long, long time.
Director Mike Ramsdell joins us now. Mike, this film is titled When Elephants Fight. That's the first part of an old proverb. Tell me what it means.
Perfect. Great place to start. When elephants fight is the African proverb. When elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. And when looking at the issues of Congo and the complexities of Congo, it seemed to me the most appropriate analogy or metaphor as to the struggling in that country, that since the Berlin Conference, since King Leopold came and declared Congo his own, the history of Congo has been external elephants fighting over the resources in that country and the Congolese people being the grass that's suffering.
And never or rarely, maybe some of the politicians benefiting. The film uses the term conflict minerals, which reminded me of the better known term that we're all familiar with, blood diamonds. Yes. Explain what the minerals are and what the conflict is surrounding them today.
I will give you the brief version.
Sure.
And then we can go deeper. Conflict minerals specifically are tungsten, tin, tantalum, and gold. Those minerals are found in pretty much every electronic device we use today, from laptops, cell phones, MP3 players, etc., automobiles, airplanes. The eastern portion of the Democratic Republic of Congo was once called the geological scandal because it is littered with these minerals. Most of these minerals are mined artisanally. They don't have the infrastructure to do the large industrial mining. So what you'll see is when you're flying over or traveling through the country is a hillside with basically a big pit carved out of it and a bunch of individuals with picks and shovels digging these minerals. Now, because of the lack of infrastructure, because of the lack of government oversight, and because of the conflict in the nation, what you can imagine is that those resources are worth a lot of money. And so if you have the weapons, if you have the armed group that controls the area, you control those minerals. It becomes a great interest to control those because those minerals are worth a lot of money. If I control those, I can sell those minerals, I can buy weapons, I can buy political power, etc.
So that's one side of the country. The other side of the country also has minerals, but it doesn't seem to have the same level of conflict. And then the southern part of the country has well-developed processing plants that have been around for a while, but I understand they're also controversial because the government controls and has sold some of that off. So tell us why the different regions are having different issues in the same country.
And that's where the complexity of Congo. Jason Stearns, one of the leading experts on Congo, said that the curse of Congo is its complexity. And that's incredibly accurate because it is a huge country, the largest landmass country in Africa. It reaches basically sea to sea, 11 countries border it. And the infrastructure of the nation, to go back a little bit to the 60s when the Democratic Republic of Congo had its first elected president, Patrice Lumumba.
Right.
Soon
became,
thereafter.
Became
yeah,
independent.
From became the,
like
independent.
Like a lot of African countries
exactly,
in the 60s.
Exactly. And he was unfortunately assassinated, and there's a lot of evidence that the United States and Belgium was behind that assassination. And then a gentleman by the name of Mobutu Sese Seko took over the country, and he was a Western-supported dictator because he was our ally in the Cold War. And Mobutu's strategy to maintain control over the country was very effective. He didn't allow infrastructure to take place, no development of infrastructure, to keep the country separated. Because when people can come together, when they can gather, when they can communicate, when they can convene, their frustrations can mount up, they can mount a coup, whatever it may be. So his thought was, we'll keep the country, keep the regions very separated from each other, and therefore the people will be separated and he would be able to control the country significantly.
So this was by design.
This was absolutely by design, and it was incredibly effective. Unfortunately, since Mobutu fell in 1996, the country has not had the kind of rebound to redevelop any infrastructure or put any in place.
So in fairly recent history, that country has been crossed by a number of different countries' armies. People have suffered those big elephants you've been talking about. I read someplace, I think it was a BBC examination, that 9 different countries have trekked across at one time or other with arms to take advantage of some of these mineral deposits or to establish an outpost. That's a real mess. So why is it the UN or the African Union or somebody else? Why haven't they come in there and protected those people and their interests?
Well, that's one of the sadder stories of this. The UN actually has the largest UN ground force in the world in Congo. And it's still not been very effective. Now, you can get into discussions about the efficacy of the UN and their ground forces or the complexity of Congo, and that won't be the topic of our conversation. But they have. And billions of dollars of aid pour into Congo. So it's not that people are turning a complete blind eye. It's that the analogy I like to use is that people are more focused on treating the burn victims than they are on putting out the fire. And that's where When Elephants Fight, my film, comes in, is that I thought, well, it's incredibly important that we at least begin the conversation on what some of the root causes are of this, how we begin to battle this fire, if you will. Now, there's no way that I would say that minerals are the sole cause or the resources are the sole cause of the conflict in Congo. That would be far too simple, and it would be far too easy to fix that. But you cannot look at the history of Congo without using resources as a through thread of the conflict that has torn that country apart. We'll get back to your earlier question. In eastern Congo, you have the artisanal mining that are finding the armed groups and the unsavory characters there. In southern Congo, one of the largest copper belts in the world runs through the southern province of Katanga. And with copper comes cobalt. Now, those are two strategic metals, very essential for not only our industrial military equipment, but also pretty much any piece of electronic equipment built today. This room, I'm sure, is loaded with copper. Those minerals require industrial mining. You have to bring in the big machines. You have to have the know-how. In Congo, based on the Constitution, constitutionally mandated that all the minerals and the resources in the country belong to the people of the country. Congo has some state-owned mining companies, specifically Gécamines, which is its largest mining company, owns all of those concessions. So what they do in theory, and in theory it's a great practice, they don't have the infrastructure to mine, so they work with company X, Y, or Z. That company comes in, they pay, you know, we'll pay you this much money to own this much, we'll mine, and then the revenues will be split between the Congolese people and this company. In theory, that's a great practice. What happens, unfortunately, is that mining company X, Y, or Z, in this case, the film focuses on two mining companies, Glencore and ENRC, will come in and they do business with these gentlemen or with these leaders in an opaque way, in a BVI-based company. Bribes will be paid to whomever, and then the mine will be sold for very, very small amounts of money, maybe 5, 10% of what it's worth. Then whoever owns the mine, whoever it's been sold to, will flip that mine to another external mining company at market value and make up to 800% profits on that. Now, all of that money goes to the company that was able to make the bribe and make the deal in the first place. None of that money goes to the Congolese people. So we're talking about a country that is one of the lowest in the UN Index of Development. Global Witness and Africa Progress Panel, which is Kofi Annan's organization, did a study in 2014, and they looked at just five deals. And in those five deals, $1.5 billion was lost to the Congolese people. And if you look at that number, $1.5 billion, that's more than double of what the Congolese government spends on health and education in a year. Those profits going to these corporations, these Western-based corporations based in Toronto, based in London, based in New York, are making those profits, are going to shareholders, which maybe your pension is vested in it, maybe, you know, you have to know, but we're profiting off of it. The minerals are going into the products that we're living off of and benefiting off of, and the Congolese people are left with a country that has been racked with war for almost 20-plus years.
So how does a guy born in Flint, Michigan, still lives in the state, how do you get involved in a project like this? What brought it to your attention, and why did you decide this is my next film?
In 2009, I was introduced to Congo by a small nonprofit based in Los Angeles that took me there to take some pictures and make some small videos for them as they're on a fact-finding mission. And once I say that once you get introduced to Congo, you can't un-Congo yourself. It is a juxtaposition of the most extreme. The beauty of the country, the beauty of the people, the mountains are incredibly lush. There's volcanoes. There is the Great Lakes region. So we have the Great Lakes here in Michigan. They have the same thing in Africa. That is juxtaposed against some of the worst human atrocity that you can imagine. Unfortunately, Congo has been called the rape capital of the world. I don't remember exactly the stats, and I think they've changed a bit. But in essence, one woman is raped every 45 seconds.
Rape is also used as a weapon of war.
Exactly right. It was introduced primarily as a weapon of war, and then it's become an epidemic. You have the actual confrontation and the violence, the displacement of the citizens. Refugees are what people know of people who have to flee their country. We recognize that in Syria. In Congo, what you have is IDPs, which are internally displaced persons, where they don't necessarily flee the country. They just flee to a different portion of their country, but live under the same kind of squalor conditions in refugee camps. Over 2 million refugees, IDPs, living in Congo right now. The mortality rate, this war has taken approximately 5.5 million lives. That's the worst human crisis on planet Earth since World War II. So when you get introduced to that, when you look around, when you meet the Congolese people, when you see the beauty of the country, when you see the endless possibility of these resources, and you see this massive amount of suffering, that's almost 6 million people. That's a staggering number and almost impossible to wrap your head around, and yet nobody's talking about it.
Your film, When Elephants Fight, was chosen as the opening documentary for the Edinburgh Film Festival. It'll premiere on Netflix on October the 2nd. What message do you want your audience to take away when they finish watching your film?
It's very clear. It's written right at the end of the movie. Stand with Congo. That's the campaign. What we've done is we've made a film, and we've made a campaign that goes along with the film called Stand with Congo. Go to the website, standwithcongo.org. You can ask for a screening, and we'll send you a copy of the movie. You host a screening. You can sign a petition that will be sent, and that is gathering and being sent to these mining corporations and these electronic companies, saying that we as consumers of these devices and shareholders in these companies want transparency in the dealing in Congo. And it allows us, with that kind of momentum, that allows us the kind of pressure to put on the policymakers, that allows us the pressure to put on the corporations to get the running room necessary to have effective change in the country.
What's the response been so far?
Fantastic. We did a screening just the other day here at the University of Michigan where Dr. Mukwege, who is a Congolese doctor, who's done amazing work for survivors of rape and violence, was able to attend the screening, and it was an incredibly powerful evening. We filled the room. There was a very engaged dialogue thereafter, and a lot of people are asking exactly that question, what can I do? And so, more importantly, the steps are all in place that we really want you to take. Stand with Congo.
So the film is When Elephants Fight. It'll be released on Netflix on October 2nd. You can find it there. Mike Ramsdell is a Michigan-based filmmaker, and that is his latest project. Thanks for coming in and telling us about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Drilling for gas and oil in Michigan has just about stopped completely. It wasn't anti-fracking environmentalists. It was the markets. Oil prices dropped a couple of years ago, and they've stayed down. The success of horizontal fracking across the nation has driven natural gas prices down. And Michigan does a fair amount of gas and oil production, particularly gas. But the market drop has killed a lot of jobs in the industry. Phil Coro is the Senior Vice President of Production and Operations of Riverside Energy, Michigan, and he joins us now. The state has issued far fewer drilling permits in 2014 and 15 than in the recent past, and this year it appears there'll be even lower numbers, the lowest issued since the state started permitting in 1927, according to an article in the Detroit News. What's that look like when you're working in the industry?
Well, it just means that we have to do our work more efficiently. You know, we try to make more out of what we have. Our company has over 2,000 wells, natural gas wells that we have interest in, and we try to make our operation more efficient to try to continue operating those wells.
Yeah, I imagine finding efficiencies becomes really important when the price is like this. So what do you guys do to tighten your belts and stay ready for the next boom?
Well, I mean, we certainly look at every cost that we have. We try to decide, you know, what things we can, you know, work smarter at. Certainly technology has helped us instead of having to, you know, send people out to a location 24 hours a day. You can do a lot of that and monitor things remotely. So adding technology has certainly helped us become more efficient. That's just one way of doing it.
I understand some companies are just getting out of the business in Michigan. So what's that do for the companies left?
Well, it's like anything, you know, say if you own stock, people make decisions that, hey, you know, this stock is maybe not where I want my have my money currently. You know, it's maybe not performing. I'd rather move my money to something else, or maybe I need the cash for some other reason. So it's no different between companies here in Michigan. We were previously owned by Chevron. Chevron has other priorities. So they put this asset up for sale, and Riverside was more than happy to purchase it.
Yeah, I guess these wells are still in production, so people are buying and selling these as companies come and go. How long do you expect the market to stay down like this?
I think that we've bottomed out already. I think we're starting to see a slow climb in commodity prices again. I don't think you're going to see them take off rapidly, but I think it'll be a slow, steady climb. Most commodity markets have a tendency to correct themselves. The pendulum will swing one way, and prices will really run down, and then, you know, slowly the pendulum starts coming back the other way as you start to work out the excess and demand picks up again. We certainly are dependent on how busy the economy is, and, you know, as, you know, more factories are working here in the country, they have more energy needs, and, you know, there's also been a switch from a lot of coal-fired generation to going to other sources, and natural gas is one of those sources that they're switching to. When a price of a commodity is low, people usually find other ways how to start using that commodity, and prices start recovering.
What's the risk to the industry when you're in this state? I mean, what's the worst-case scenario for gas and oil production in Michigan? Could you be shutting down wells? Could you be cutting production? Or does production just stay what production is and you just ride the markets?
There's some wells that we may temporarily shut in during a low-price environment. We will continue to monitor those wells to make sure that they are safely shut in. But then as, you know, prices have recovered, people start turning some of those wells back on again. And there's other wells that we produce all the time because they are economic to produce all the time. So it's a well-by-well decision.
I also know that royalties from oil and gas development in Michigan go into the Natural Resources Trust Fund, and that's money that's used for improving wildlife habitat, buying parks, and keeping up some maintenance on some of the parks. I guess they've learned to live with this up and down boom and bust cycle of the oil and gas industry as well at the state. But it is a factor that affects people who might not even realize it affects their lives.
You know, you bring up a good point. I don't think a lot of people realize where that source of funding comes from, and it is from oil and gas royalties. And we're very proud as an industry to be able to contribute to that. Most people in this industry enjoy the outdoors. We like to have parks and clean water and, you know, places to hunt and fish and get out and boat, and we're really proud that we do contribute to that fund.
And I guess I have to ask you, when the markets return, I know that some horizontal fracking pilot drills were done in the state here and there. Not a lot of great production. Is horizontal fracking going to be a big thing in Michigan?
You know, that's a well-by-well decision. You can't really just put it in one box because different targets that you go for need to be treated differently. You know, out in the Marcellus Shale, you know, they found out that that was the ticket to unlock the trapped reserves in the rock. We have formations here, Dundee, Niagara, that they do not require fracking to produce those particular horizons. Now you look at the Collingwood Shale, the Antrim Shale, those formations have required fracking. So it all depends on what Mother Nature is providing and, you know, what the opportunities are to extract the resource.
Phil Coro is the Senior Vice President of Production and Operations of Riverside Energy Michigan. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
State government has been distracted by the water contamination crisis it created in Flint, by the funding issues in Detroit schools, the day-to-day issues that are just a natural part of running a huge operation in a large state. One issue that's been set aside often, the proverbial kicking the can down the road, is underfunded pension plans and health care costs for retirees. At the state level, Governor Snyder implemented a plan early in his first term to chip away at the problem. At the local level, most cities have been struggling with cutting services and just paying the bills. The idea of trying to catch up on putting more money into pension plans or setting aside money for growing retiree health care costs just don't seem to be as pressing. The result, a looming financial disaster for many cities and counties. For example, the Michigan State University Extension Center for Local and Government Finance and Policy shows cities such as Lansing, Warren, Flint, they have liabilities, shortcomings of hundreds of millions of dollars. If that seems a lot for a local government, it really is. But the state is getting some help. Eric Scorsone works at the MSU Extension Center. He's an economist and an expert on municipal financing, and he's taking a sabbatical and going to work as Senior Deputy Treasurer for Finance for the state, and he joins us now. First, congratulations. When are you going to start working for the Department of Treasury?
We'll be transitioning over the next week or so.
So just how much of a problem are things like retiree health care costs and underfunded pension funds for municipalities?
It's a huge problem. It's probably the biggest problem they face today other than infrastructure, you know, billions of dollars that are not going funded. And these commitments are coming due. The costs are starting to rise now, so it's not a far-off problem. I probably have to rank it as, you know, one of the top two problems that local governments face in Michigan.
So infrastructure being the first?
Well, they'd be in a close tie, probably. Infrastructure and legacy costs, yeah.
So this is not a new problem. Underfunded liabilities have been looming for years. We've been talking about it for years. Has any local government kept liabilities fully funded? Anybody doing a good job?
There are some out there. I mean, a lot of the very small governments, like townships, don't offer these benefits. So it's mostly bigger cities, counties, and some of the larger townships. Oakland County has done a pretty good job of adjusting their benefits. They did some bonding to kind of close the gap. And so that would be an example of one that has done a good job. Of course, it's also a very wealthy county. Yeah, you know, there's a few other smaller cities that have adjusted. You know, the unions have come to the table and agreed to changes. We often see things like going to defined contribution plans, things of that nature. But, you know, for many of our communities, they're still not where they need to be right now.
The Michigan Municipal League, which represents local governments, says the state's decision to take part of the sales tax that used to go to municipalities to pay for the state's obligations has made the problem worse. In other words, revenue sharing. What has your research shown?
It's a multi-pronged problem. Municipalities definitely are facing stress. Their revenues are not growing that much, so they have that challenge. On the cost side, cost pressures are tremendous, and particularly in pensions and health care and employee costs in general. So basically, the math doesn't work very well for them. It's high costs and you know, revenues not growing at a really robust pace. And so when you combine those two things, you know, the infrastructure problem is tied to this because essentially as pension costs are rising faster than inflation, that means we're not going to be able to fund the infrastructure piece. So it's, you know, it's all the pieces are connected. We're facing some real challenges right now.
You've been providing hard data to the public and government for a while. That's a valuable service. So what do you think you can do within Treasury that you cannot do as a researcher for MSU's Extension Service?
You know, as a researcher, it's, you know, you have the ability to really look at things, take your time, assess the problems, put out reports, all very valuable things that hopefully we do for the citizens of Michigan. You know, I've been thinking about this for 10 years, and so really trying to see how I can help in the decision-making process as an advisor, as someone who can help think about strategy and put those skills to the test. And I hope I can, you know, be productive and help out.
I want to break down things just a little bit because I didn't realize, I knew that underfunded pension plans are supposed to be paid in advance as you go, but the retiree health care, there's not a pre-funded account for that. A lot of these municipalities are actually just paying, and as health care costs have gone up in a surprising manner, it basically blows out any kind of projections that even the most wise and prepared city could plan for. Is that the bigger problem these days, even more than pensions, the retiree health care costs?
In some ways it is. It's more widespread. And the reason is we didn't even have in the accounting standards you had to report your liability for retiree health care until 2008. So governments were making promises back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and not even having any real sense of the financial implications until very recently. And so those were often very shocking numbers. And you're right, unlike pensions where accounting standards and pre-commitment to funding has been around for decades, we didn't have that. And so there were very few that did it. And so, yeah, it's often a much bigger number. There are different strategies on how you deal with healthcare versus pensions, but yeah, absolutely. In some ways, it is kind of a more widespread problem.
I want to ask you a sort of political question. The administration of Rick Snyder does not have great influence with the Michigan legislature. A Gongwer News report indicates those unfunded liabilities will be a top priority for the governor next legislative session. What kind of reception do you expect to get from legislators, given that you're part of the administration now?
I don't know, honestly. I can't answer that for sure. I hope they will listen. We'll try and bring the facts and data and evidence and ideas, and I hope we have a partnership. I don't know, honestly, for sure how that will work out.
Do you think you have an advantage because the only thing you have behind you is your research and you're not carrying around a lot of political baggage? So does that help?
It's a good question. I don't know, honestly. I hope they will. I'm going to try and bring the best information and evidence I can to the debate and to the governor and the legislature. And I hope we can have a vigorous and productive discussion and see where we can move forward together on.
Eric Scorsone is an economist with MSU Extension and an expert on municipal financing. He's taking a sabbatical and going to work for the state of Michigan's Department of Treasury as Senior Deputy Treasurer for Finance. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester.
Let's turn now to Michigan Bookmark, our series where notable Michigan writers review the works of other Michigan writers. Histopia is the debut novel by author David Means. It concerns an alternate history of the United States in which John F. Kennedy was not assassinated. Andy Mozina has this review.
Histopia, the first novel of acclaimed Michigan short story writer David Means, is a complex book built around a simple question. What can we do about the trauma that war inflicts on our veterans? The novel explores this question by posing an alternative history. President Kennedy has survived multiple assassination attempts, and now in his third term, wages war in Vietnam. On the home front, pollution, rioting, and the economy are far worse than in the real late 60s. Interestingly, the novel doesn't blame Kennedy or some other alternative historical development for these conditions. Instead, it suggests that Nam was seeping home. In other words, this dystopian America reflects the trauma the vets have experienced. Sensitized to mental health issues by his sister Rose, Kennedy has created the Psych Corps to address the emotional wounds of returning service people. Headquartered in Michigan, which becomes a magnet for vets, the Psych Corps administers a process that enfolds or suppresses the memories of trauma through a combination of battle reenactments and drugs. This is a fantasy answer. Make the bad memories inaccessible. The plot is driven by a vet for whom this treatment backfired, amplifying his trauma. Rake, deranged even before he went to Vietnam, is now on a murderous rampage throughout Michigan. He's taken Meg, the widow of a veteran, as a hostage, and between his killing sprees, he stays with Hank, a vet with a love of Michigan forests. Hank knows that the only way to stop Rake is to kill him, but he worries if he does it himself, he'll relapse into a life of violence. Meanwhile, two rogue Psych Corps agents, Wendy and Singleton, also pursue Rake. These characters have a lot of shared history, but they don't know it because each has been through the treatment. However, through cold water immersion in Lake Superior and intense sex, they partially reaccess their memories and share their stories. Which implies another possible answer to trauma, the storytelling cure. And this book's story is framed in a complex way. The bulk of Histopia is a novel written by a fictional Vietnam vet, Eugene Allen. This text is sandwiched between interview excerpts and other writings that comment on Allen's life and his novel. In the secondary material, we learn that things do not end well for Allen or for his real-life sister, on whom the character of Meg is based. The book as a whole thus suggests that Allen has used storytelling to make his own experience more bearable, yet this is complicated by the knowledge that Allen has committed suicide. But while storytelling ironically fails the novelist, it helps his characters bond with each other. What works best for dealing with trauma? Love, of course, as Meg and Hank and Singleton and Wendy develop intimate relationships. And a sense of honor also plays a key role in resolving the novel's conflicts. Means' good-hearted couples ultimately light up the novel's bleak landscape. The book makes explicit references to Hemingway, another vet who sought solace in Michigan's woods. But the novel's formal complexity, its rich language, and sometimes stream-of-consciousness style more strongly recall Faulkner, who famously said, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." Means' brilliant novel suggests that wars never end, and they're not even foreign. They always seep home, as our veterans struggle to re-enter a society that sadly doesn't always know how to acknowledge or help them with their experiences. This thrilling adventure novel is also a powerful critique of our own ongoing attempts to enfold our wars elsewhere.
Andy Mozina is the author of two short fiction collections and a new novel, Contrary Motion. His first collection, The Women Were Leaving the Men, won the Great Lakes College's Association New Writers Award. His review of the book, Histopia, by David Means, can be found at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Peg Watson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, thanks for listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio.